On Friday, gold closed at the highest point in 1 month on renewed geopolitical instability. Hello, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek. It's a pleasure to be back with you this weekend with an all-new episode packed with must-hear info, including top interviews from your favorite investment gurus and economists, as well as the financial market headlines affecting your portfolio. First out of the bullpen, John Williams from ShadowStats.com says the Fed's quantitative easing has failed because the bank balance sheets are still toxic, so lenders are not lending, and that's stifling the intended economic output. Trillions of dollars added to the Fed's balance sheet simply kicked the massive recessionary can down the road, and the net result could be a domestic depression. Disruptions in the flow of grocery products and other necessities could become a common occurrence, as well as rapidly rising prices resulting with hyperinflation, making gold and silver the go-to survival asset class. Next on the pitcher's mound, Bill Murphy from Gata.org says that few media outlets are interested in the price suppression story despite the mountains of supporting evidence. Gold stock manipulation may include naked short selling, a nefarious practice available only to the elite, which artificially dilutes share prices, crushing the wheat with the chaff. But the machination will eventually backfire as it requires up to 5 years to get a mine back into production, which could create a gold supply void and subsequently send prices into the stratosphere. Bill Murphy cites friend of the show Eric Sprott, who expects silver to run back to 50 and then on to triple digits, and he outlines his gold forecast. Then the Gold Seek team closing relief pitcher Robert Ian wraps up the show, recording yet another perfect game. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recapitulation. Mostly sunny skies were seen over the gold market. The metal closed at a four-week high this week as geopolitical concerns recaptured investors' attention. U.S. officials announced that Russia was threatening to invade Ukraine on news of a large buildup of forces at the national border. The U.S. dollar recoiled from a recent high, helping the yellow metal find support. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold added $16, finishing at $13.11, still higher for the year by 6%. Silver gave back only 40 cents, finishing just shy of $20. Palladium dropped only 6, and platinum futures added 12, ending at $14.78 an ounce. Both platinum and palladium are showing solid signs, though, of accumulation in the charts, a positive for the precious metals. And West Texas Intermediate crude finished at nearly the break-even point for the week, ending right around $97.65 a barrel. Well, the top story influencing the markets this week was clearly the equities implosion. Stocks imploded early on in the week, but then as tensions flared again between Russia and Ukraine, investors worried over corporate profits amid a potential new Cold War scenario between the West and Russia. Investment flow shifted away from the equities and into gold on renewed threats of economic sanctions against Russia from the White House on Friday. Russia massed troops along the Ukraine border. U.S. officials announced that the move indicates a solid threat of a full-scale Ukrainian invasion. Russian President Vladimir Putin retorted with bans on food imports and threatened to target the automotive, shipping, and aerospace sectors. Russia's stock bourse fell about 2% on the news before recovering somewhat on Friday. Meanwhile, on Thursday night, the U.S. president announced airstrikes against militants in Iraq, where thousands of civilians are trapped without provisions on a mountaintop in northern Iraq in a biblical-like Masada situation. In addition, relief airdrops for thousands of refugees driven from their homes are expected, and emergency assistance in northern Iraq to protect American personnel and prevent a humanitarian tragedy. The group seized large portions of northern Iraq, according to reports last month, including the nation's largest water reservoir and dam this week. Turning to other geopolitical news, the European Central Bank held rates unchanged at record lows as the Ukrainian crisis strengthened. Leaders cited risks to the Eurozone economic recovery due in part to the Ukrainian-Russia drama. Lower rates are inherently inflationary and viewed as a positive for the yellow metal. On a lighter note, gold coins commemorating the 50th anniversary of the John F. Kennedy half dollar caused a bit of a stir in Denver, Colorado. On Thursday, hundreds of people rushed, even trampled others underfoot, just to get in line at the U.S. Mint. So what was the cause of all the commotion? Well, officials changed course, announcing that no further JFK coins would be minted. A total of just 800 of the proof sets were available. They're 24-karat gold, unlike the typical 90% gold coins. They went on sale on Tuesday morning for $1,240, but some buyers were paid as much as $600 just for the opportunity to stand in line to procure coins for others. The coins contain 3/4 of a troy ounce of 0.9999 fine 24-karat gold, and they were struck at the U.S. Mint's facility in West Point. Bottom line on the precious metals. So the question I think on many investors' minds this week is, if gold closed at a four-week high, why did silver continue its pullback? You know, I think the quick answer here is the run to safety by big investors into gold and global uncertainty, including the impending Argentine default. In addition, economic weakness dampens the industrial output for silver. We've seen relatively solid economic numbers, but they're really not impressing most or surpassing the expectations of most economists and analysts. Sluggishness there. But, you know, as I've mentioned in the past few weeks, we should be passing out of the summer doldrums in the next few weeks and months, and that tends to lead to holiday-related shopping and purchases. So weakness is still viewed as a buying opportunity. Well, moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly cloudy skies remained over the New York Stock Exchange. Investors continued to book profits amid lackluster support from the FOMC last week and global instability concerns. Nevertheless, the Dow and all the major indices closed mostly higher. The Dow added 60 points, finishing at 16,553. The S&P was up about 6, wrapping up at 1931, while the NASDAQ added 18, closing at 4370. On the economic news front, wholesale inventories improved last month, but lower than anticipated by analysts, giving the bears additional ammunition. Plus, U.S. worker productivity improved 2.5%, according to a Labor Department report. Nonetheless, traders booked profits on jitters over global instability, despite solid signs of accumulation in the charts on Friday across the board. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, our 7-component sentiment index pendulum remains in the extremely fearful level. In fact, it's still the deepest reading I've seen in at least 3 years. And this, I think, is indicative of solid signs of accumulation in the indices. So a rebound could be in the cards in the next week or two. Here's a quick public announcement. I'd like to encourage and challenge all of my subscribers and listeners to embrace an animal-friendly lifestyle, including personal items like shoes and wallets, belts. You can go with synthetics nowadays, and you might just save several animals' lives. The neat thing is, thanks to Jeff Bezos' Amazon.com, it's relatively inexpensive. In some cases, you might even save a few bucks by purchasing synthetic and animal-friendly clothing items. You can find several links with free Amazon Prime shipping in the Alpha Stocks newsletter. And incidentally, we had several winning stocks this week, despite all the market volatility, including a rock-solid gold company that's poised to blast higher by maybe 100-200% or more. Plus, I'm reposting this weekend a gold-backed investment security that pays about a 10% dividend, and it's soared since we first added it to the Alpha Stock newsletter. So if you haven't signed up, what's stopping you? We have reasonable annual and monthly rates. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with this week's special guests, Bill Murphy and John Williams. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. It's a pleasure to welcome back GATA's chairman, Bill Murphy, trying to help folks understand what's going on in the precious metals markets with all the manipulation. It's a pleasure to have you back on the show, Bill Murphy.
Great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
You say that manipulation is a much bigger problem than most people think, that the mainstream media might even be complicit in the suppression. And I'd like to give you a chance here to talk about how this could be so explosive for the metals prices.
A mouthful in a way, because there's so much, you know, to all of that. It's fairly complex in a sense, and in a way, it's pretty simple. I mean, basically, the GATA story is not allowed to be said. I mean, we know this from Bloomberg, who's told us that the Claudia Carpenter has been there forever, that she can't mention this. And I was on CNBC 15 years ago, not allowed back. BNN won't have us on, and it's so bad that and such a big deal that they won't even come up with a he said, she said kind of thing, which, you know, people can make up their own minds. And what part of it's because of the United States government's involved. You've got one scandal after another in every financial market. I mean, it's unbelievable how rampant it is. And yet, when it comes to our subject, it's like it's toxic. And the bottom line is that price of gold is probably half of what it should be if it kept up with inflation. And it's an artificially low price. And when final aspect of all that is that they've been meddling in all the markets, whether it's the stock market, everyone knows about the bond market and currency markets, and gold, of course, is the biggie. And when it's leading to something where it's like a communist system. It's going to blow up because they try to control it so much with derivatives, et cetera.
You know, I think there's really two big problems here that's keeping this story under wraps from the masses. Firstly, it involves that, you know, that adage, it's hard to convince someone of the truth if it is going to jeopardize their livelihood, their wherewithal. Most of the media outlets earn revenues primarily. I mean, their paychecks, their bread and butter come from those who are complicit in this manipulation. I think that's one big component. Unfortunately, you know, I mean, you've really got to almost have a legal mindset or an investigative mindset to where you're going to drill down into the minutiae and find out just what's going on. And here's an example. For instance, we just found out that Barclays had a $44 million fine in evidence in a probe against gold price manipulation.
In that article that you were kind enough to put up, I talked about it's like a murder trial where if anybody had time or wanted the interest to look at all the evidence God has collected, the person on trial would be, you know, found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt and sentenced to death. I mean, it's that obvious. I mean, even like yesterday where one of my colleagues and God of people, James McShirley, circled the day before if gold was going to go up 2%, what would the price be? And he circled the number, came out exact to the tick. This is how controlled this is. Well, the way I see it is just naked shorting. Well, that's the way I see it, and I'm sure they are. And right now, the public has no interest in the gold-silver shares, and we all know how poorly they've done for years now, and it's going to turn. And in my opinion, it's going to lead to, it's going to be a mania as big as the internet thing was at the end of the 1990s before this is over. The public has never come our way yet, and that's coming. And it might be when gold takes out 2,000, I don't know, but it's coming.
Dumping hundreds of thousands, even perhaps millions of shares that are created out of thin air, you're not borrowing from someone else in order to short. You're literally printing money that dilutes the share base, and this crushes the price. And we've seen hundreds of solid companies with great business plans go out of business. What I think the travesty here is, and what will ultimately come back to bite them, and which could send the metals sky high just on its own merits, is you debase these mining companies, which, you know, they already face really tight margins as it is. I mean, it is a difficult business to make profitable, just like any other business. But I mean, there are some big overhead costs here. And when they see their share prices get crushed, well, suddenly their access to capital evaporates. And what I'm afraid is we're going to see more and more of these solid mining companies close their doors, creating a vacuum. When the price starts to turn around, it can take 5, 6, even 7 years to get these mines back online.
Today, it's obvious, you know, with the geopolitical noise and about Russia, Ukraine, and even some talk about meddling in Iraq, you know, that gold's trading the opposite of the stock market. As it gets hit, the gold catches a bid. And it's probably the most disturbing thing for me short term is what they're doing to silver. And it's either because the silver fundamentals stink, which I don't believe, or they've got such a problem with silver, they're going after it. I mean, the gold and silver the past few days have just, you know, acting completely differently. And it's something is very wrong there, and I think it's because the JPM crowd has a big problem. Now, we'll see, and all in retrospect what we know, when we'll find out when silver and takes out 22. If it does and it explodes, then it's because they've had a big problem and they're doing everything they can to keep the price down. But we'll see.
I think what's happening to silver here is just an overreaction. You know, when you start to see the equities implode, people get nervous about the global prospects of the, obviously, the global economy. And, you know, there's that industrial component.
But, Chris, if I may interrupt you, then why in the years that we've seen the Dow go up and up and up, why didn't silver go up, have an effect when it was going up? Why is it always when it goes down?
This is all going to change. If we look at the typical bear market over the past few years, I mean, whether it be crude oil, all the way back to the dot-com implosion and then 2003 recovery, even housing, you know, it didn't take much more than three and a half years before we found a solid bottom, and you're going to see at least a 50% relief rally, even if the bull market doesn't reestablish itself right away, perhaps leading up to a capitulation?
Well, no, I think I'm an Eric Spott fan. I think you got $100 silver in the cards, and then once we take out 22, and it's going to start to move and explode, when it takes out 50, the next stop's going to be 100, and that's for starters. I think it's going to be just a staggering move, and it's unfortunately, it's taking longer than I thought it would have, and the base in silver is getting bigger and bigger and bigger to support such a move, and here we are.
Great point. Anything that they need to be watching for? Should we be looking for a bottom? We get these summer doldrums, you know, in the markets before the holiday season. Manufacturers and the jewelers start to stock up, and then we've got all that holiday-related buying, and then, of course, we have the upcoming wedding season in India. So we've got some good positive seasonal factors.
One thing that's obviously noticeable is that gold keeps bouncing off 1280 time and time again. It's on the move back up again, and if it takes out 1326, it could very easily shoot for 1400. So it's got to do that first, but it could come out of nowhere.
Probably read that article this week where Russia just signed a big oil deal with Iran. I mean, talk about the end of the petrodollar. Then you've got India's central bank governor, renowned forecaster and worked with the IMF, and he says a massive global financial collapse and meltdown, as big if not bigger than 2008, is just around the corner, could lead to a big rebound in the metals. It's just a no-brainer, and I know you're all in.
Yeah, I've been doing it for since 1998. It's almost 16 years now, and people can sign up for a two-week free trial if they are interested. And then as far as GATA is concerned, go to www.gata.org. Chris Powell, my colleague, does a great job there and sends out all kinds of good stuff, and we're going to continue to fight the good fight.
Very good. Well, I just want to give a shout out to our Chris Mullen here at Goldseek, who found your article. That was one of the reasons why we wanted to have you on the show today. Bill Murphy, always a pleasure. Please keep up the great work at Gata.org with Chris Powell, La Metropole Cafe. We appreciate all that you and Chris Powell do.
Thanks for all you do, Chris. Have a good one.
Well, it's a pleasure to have Mr. John Williams, head economist at ShadowStats.com. It's an alternative online economic resource. Welcome back, John Williams.
Chris, thank you so much for having me.
As I'm sure you know by now, they cut the QE there for, what, another $10 billion, I suppose. I think that's the sixth time in a row. We had another FOMC meeting. The Fed is quite sanguine regarding the prospects of this economy. My guess is, though, that doesn't really jibe with what your numbers are showing. Could you tell us more, please?
Sure. I'll contend that the primary reason for the quantitative easing as we have seen it, it was never designed to help boost the economy except as an after effect. The Fed's primary function is to keep the banking system solvent and functioning. That was the that was the crux of the crisis in back in 2000. Although the Fed has a mandate from Congress in terms of maintaining economic activity and containing inflation, it's not a federal government operation. It's a private operation owned by the banking system, designed to keep the banking system afloat and functioning. As the crisis broke in 2008, a variety of actions were taken, both by the Fed and by the federal government, to prevent a systemic collapse. I'm talking a collapse of the banking system, which would have been disastrous had it happened. We should never have gotten to that point. There are all sorts of reasons as to why we got to that point. But nonetheless, between the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, they created, spent whatever money they had to. They bailed out all sorts of companies, ranging from General Motors to AIG, the large insurance company. And they did everything they could to keep the banks intact. And part of that process was to get liquidity to the banks through this quantitative easing. This has been going on and off since then. And back in January of last year, the Fed increased its so-called quantitative easing 3, its QE3, to include the buying of U.S. Treasury securities, Treasury bonds, notes, and such. That has the effect of actually pumping money directly into the money supply because of taking a depositor money and putting it into the into the treasuries. Excuse me, not depositor money, but the effect is that the treasury wants to borrow money. It goes out to the public. Say it borrows $10 billion, and the public buys the treasuries. The cash comes out of the public's checking accounts and such. So that's a direct reduction in the money supply. But when the Treasury receives the cash, it's raising the cash because it has to make payments. It makes payments back out to the public, and that gets deposited in the banks and goes into the money supply. So it's a net wash. When the Federal Reserve is buying the treasuries instead of the public, you don't have the drain in the money supply from the public buying the treasury, so that when the treasury cuts its checks and mails it out to the public, that actually increases the money supply.
So you're essentially printing money.
It is, and it is a net effect. They could actually be buying it directly from the treasury, in which case they're directly printing the money. But they normally buy it through the banking system, which buys it from the treasury. It's the same thing. The effect is exactly the same. There's no difference with it. And the that would normally boost the money supply, and you'd see all sorts of positive effects. But that's not happening, and hasn't happened since the crisis. The banks are not in good shape. The reason they're not lending money. The reason that all this money that has been plugged into their liquidity has gone back to the Federal Reserve sitting there as excess reserves. The banks are not lending it out into the system. If they lend it out into the system, that would be healthy to the system, or at least it would tend to stimulate growth and business activities. The problems is that the problems the banks still have unhealthy balance sheets. They can't lend money the way they'd like to. So even when the Fed... Fed's buying the treasuries and effectively monetizing the debt, the effect on the money supply is still minimal, but it does have some effect. Going forward here, what we're seeing, despite all the hype about 4% growth in the second quarter GDP, is that the economy never recovered. All the liquidity that the Fed's been pumping into the banking system, they've done under the political cover of a weak economy. We're trying to bring down unemployment or something along those lines. Yet the former Fed chairman you referenced, Mr. Bernanke, very openly admitted in some of his press conferences that there's very little the Fed could do to stimulate the economy at this point, that they were using what happened in the economy as a guidepost. They can't. They have no way really of affecting it now. They can always cool off the economy, and they can always increase inflation. But to do the tough things like stimulate economic growth or to contain inflation, that's increasingly difficult for the Fed to do. So I mean I've been talking around in circles here. Let me get right to the point. The issue here is that the U.S. economy never recovered, and in fact has started to turn down again. We saw a downturn in the first quarter. The numbers we saw in the second quarter so far, which are going to be revised twice, were very heavily bloated by some artificial numbers that will tend to disappear in revision. You're going to see on an ongoing basis that we have entered a new recession. You look at all the projections in terms of the health of the banking system, in terms of the size of the federal budget deficit going forward. All that is based on assumptions of ongoing positive economic growth, not renewed contraction in the headline numbers. And as the economy weakens, and it is, despite the tapering that the Fed has done for a variety of political reasons in its quantitative easing, it's still going to have to provide more liquidity to the banking system to keep it afloat. And irrespective of any noises that anybody makes politically about not bailing out the banks, they're going to bail out the banks. That's the last thing they'll let go here. So in order to bail out the banks, you're going to see more quantitative easing overtly or covertly. I would expect overtly, but they'll do it again under the political cover of a weakening economy, and we're trying to help the economy. So, number one, the economy's not good. Number two, this gives the Fed continued cover for bailing out the banking system. We have a renewed crisis coming there that will have to be addressed. We never got out of a 2008. The economy didn't recover. The banking system didn't recover. And the all that they did was to push a tremendous liquidity crisis into the future, and that we still have to live with and work out with the problems. Had they been addressed at the time or addressed years and decades ago, and perhaps might not be troubling us now.
Very little has changed since 2008. I mean, one would have thought that this was the big wake-up call, you know, that this was the moment where we would recognize the error of our ways by dissolving the Glass-Steagall Act. I mean, obviously, we'd made a mistake there in several along the way. We'd allowed virtually anyone who could fog a mirror to purchase a home to try to pull us out of the abyss there in 2002, 2003. And it worked for a time, but you start to kick this can down the road, and before you know it, it's a $4 trillion balance sheet at the Fed can. And by not recognizing the mess that we got ourselves into in 2008 and allowing for this, I guess it amounted to $700 billion bailout, but at that it morphed, I think, close to $2 trillion. How do we not find ourselves back in another 2008 ordeal?
Well, we're going to be back in it. Again, as I think I mentioned earlier, where we were on the brink of collapse in 2008, we shouldn't have been there. But at that point, things had gone too far. There was nothing much that could be done. All these guys are doing is trying to keep pushing things into the future. They don't have a solution. We have issues here that go back decades, and let me just highlight two of them. One is the federal deficit, and despite all the noise about, it's coming down, look, we're only going to have $400 billion in deficit this year. Those are not real numbers. They're cash numbers. They actually have all sorts of gimmicks in them now with dividends from entities such as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which if they were properly accounted for, would be consolidated with the U.S. government's operations. It would make the U.S. government's operations look even worse. But when you look at the accounting of the federal government and use generally accepted accounting principles, GAAP, the way big corporations do their accounting, and allow for the increasing unfunded liabilities for Social Security and Medicare, what you'll see is that we're seeing an annual deficit now in the vicinity of $6 trillion. That's not containable. You couldn't bring that into balance if you wanted to in a given year. You couldn't raise taxes enough. You couldn't cut spending enough without touching the Medicare and Social Security, which nobody in Washington wants to touch. Now, that system was put out of balance, and I can't see where it wasn't deliberate. You go back to 2004, and again, this is politicians playing games here, buying happy circumstances for the short term without consideration for the long term. 2004, and they overhauled the Medicare program, put in prescription drugs. They added something like $8 trillion of unfunded liabilities, net present value, to the federal budget at that point in time. They never funded it. Couldn't be funded. At the time, our total federal debt was was about that magnitude. Effectively doubled the obligations of the federal government. Today, and again, this is now getting worse by $6 trillion a year. The federal debt is up at 17 trillion, and you add in the unfunded liabilities for Medicare and Social Security, and now the Health Care Act, you're looking at something over $90 trillion that the U.S. needs to be able to cover and going into the future out of cash. You need to have that on deposit now. That's the amount you need to have in hand to be able to earn interest on or whatever to pay off your obligations in the future. There's no way that can ever happen.
But wouldn't you argue, though, that this is really a function of a faulty ideology? For instance, back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, even part of the 90s, we were such an economic engine, we had such a solid industrial base, that we could grow our way out of the mire, that our success is really a function, a second derivative, an inflection point of that. But then suddenly the 90s comes around, and we see this industrial implosion due to many factors that we won't go into here. We're hemorrhaging over 500,000 solid-paying industrial jobs per year. We've been doing this for over a decade, over almost 6 million now lost just in the last decade. But then we had this internet and technology boom in the 90s that promised to pull us out of it. Well, that all came to an end around the year 2000, 2001. And it seems to me as though our officials were grasping at straws and said, real estate, we can hone in on this solid sector, pump that. 2006, 2007, that all came to an end. They tried once again here over the last 5 years to use real estate to pull us out. But we're starting to see the vestiges of that nascent recovery start to implode.
You're right, and that's what we have here is a confluence of horrendously mismanaged government functions. The trade picture is what killed the production jobs. We've deliberately pursued policies to encourage an ever-growing trade deficit, which is where the jobs are being lost. That has had the effect of putting the homeowner in a position where he or she cannot stay ahead of inflation. Now, when Alan Greenspan was Fed chairman, and what you're talking about there was what's the primary cause behind the ongoing economic decline and the ongoing liquidity squeeze that consumers face. Alan Greenspan, when he was Fed chairman, saw this coming. He was a very good politician, and hold my comments on this. Ability as an economist, but he did understand what was happening. And I think he understood that there was no solid economic growth coming out of this, the way the employment picture was working, where you're losing the high-paying production jobs offshore. I mean, a widening deficit is effectively a draining of wealth out of the United States. If you don't have adequate income growth to stay ahead of inflation, there's no way you can buy enough stuff to beat inflation and show positive economic growth unless you somehow can borrow that from the future. And there was the ability of the consumer you go back a decade to expand debt and make up for the income shortfall through debt expansion. And that's what Greenspan encouraged, the debt expansion. Debt build upon debt. And all this came to a head in 2008. You had the confluence of factors, the extraordinary debt explosion, the weakening economy, the loss of jobs, and the federal government spending beyond its means, all trying to buy happiness from the future, but borrowing it from the future, really, not buying. There's no way that you could create all this and have it sustained. What happened in 2008 was a culmination of all this. The system couldn't be sustained. It was going to fall apart. They bought a little time. They pushed it down the road. The same problems exist. There's no easy cure here. I wish there were, but there's no way out of this except for a major overhaul and restructuring of the system, which will happen one way or the other. As I went over the other, the politicians are going to do something serious to try and bring things into balance, or the system will just it'll crash. We're going to end up in a hyperinflationary Great Depression, which I think is the most likely course, because I don't see these guys in Washington doing anything serious to address things. What they don't seem to sense, has a good sense, that there's something wrong here, that something drastic needs to be done to bring the system into balance, I think most people would be willing to sacrifice a tremendous amount for the future if they could be assured or see a reasonable prospect of stability in the future for their for their country, for their children, economy going forward. But there's no one in Washington who's willing to admit there's a problem.
Just take a look at what Ron Paul attempted to accomplish for decades. It was a Herculean effort. He woke up a lot of people. I think the younger generations, so folks are starting, as you say, to realize something is wrong. But you know, when you find yourself, I think, born into a system, no matter how corrupt or backward it may be to the rest of the world or to the enlightened, to the initiated, it's still the only thing you know. And I'm afraid that's where we find ourselves because, you know, how do you pull yourself out of a ship that is just capsizing? It's going to take some drastic efforts, and you pointed to this. You alluded to it.
I do it be to talk to the American people and explain the severity of the circumstances that we face and that this is something that's been built up over years. It's not going to be turned around overnight. There are going to be some very uncomfortable times ahead. Nation has to be willing to sacrifice to do this, but I mean, goodness, certainly the country's done it before different times. This is as serious as anything we faced, including World War II. So it's once you have the understanding of the people, and you need to get and you need a Congress that will be cooperative. There are things that can be done to bring the fiscal system into balance. That's got to be done. If that's not done, nothing else that gets done in terms of the economy, the dollar, gold standard, anything else will make any difference. The government has to be able to function and to function on a stable basis. And you can have, indeed, social programs, particularly those that people have paid into, such as Social Security, on an ongoing basis, but they have to be made solvent. There are ways of doing it. Not everybody's going to get everything that's been promised by the government, because the government has promised things well beyond its ability ever to cover. But the system can be made soft. There's going to be an ongoing period of economic pain. We've got to change trade policy to encourage growth of actual physical production of goods in the United States. I'm not talking assembly of parts made in China. You have to change policy. Yes, you may alienate and anger some of our trading partners, but we've got to get the country to a trade surplus. Again, if you're operating in a big deficit, we've got the world's biggest one. The simple effect there is it's a way of redistributing U.S. wealth to the rest of the world. That's why people are suffering. If you can build up the surplus, we certainly have the human assets and capital of intellect to do anything that we want to do. You can turn that around, and rather than have all our products made in a place such as China at effectively slave labor rates. You can put in tariffs that will effectively put us on an even playing field where all the cost disadvantages that an American manufacturer has, and you can just look at things such as all the regulatory programs put in place by the federal government, the EPA and such. Those are very expensive. It's very difficult for an American manufacturer to cover all those costs or to pay for product liability insurance and be able to be competitive in the global markets, let alone in its own country, where the goods that are coming in are generally free of a lot of those costs. You have to put the world on an even playing field, but whatever we do, we've got to get the domestic production base moving again. That will turn the income around. That'll change a lot of things, and it may, it's going to be disruptive to world commerce, and I'm sure it will have all sorts of negative implications, but there are also going to be positive implications, and all those factors have to be balanced out by people who are running the country, but all that's happened in the last couple of decades has been generally against the trade balance of the United States and the general welfare and well-being of the American people.
You're one of the first guests to suggest this. The late Bob Chapman, a regular and best friend, who was right on board with you, who claimed that tariffs, well, we had to get exporting again so that we could rebuild our industrial productivity here, what used to be the world's economic engine. But one of the difficulties I think we're going to have getting any traction, my concern is that, you know, China and Russia, our trade partners, you know, you talked about us being the world's deficit as far as exports are concerned. Well, you know, it's just the opposite, the mirror image over there. They have the nuclear option. You know, they hold so much of our debt, so many treasuries, that were we to follow this stratagem you've offered today, how do we get around that? How do we keep them from saying, fine, you're going to pull tariffs on us? We might divest ourselves of a few trillion dollars worth of your treasuries. See what that does to your economic plan.
Well, first of all, they're going to do that anyway. Separate from that, it's a matter of a strong negotiation and having a strong president, strong military, and I mean, the U.S. Getting back in there and making its presence knowing and not cowering at the thought of losing an otherwise level of trade activity that we're subsidizing for people outside the United States.
Brilliant.
And I think you'll find that there are a lot of people who have a pretty good sense of what's going on. You don't have an environment that attracts good people into the politics. Some in substance, we have. We've gotten into some of the major problems, and I had a circumstance once where I was talking about a very bleak outlook into a directors' meeting in a bank up in New England, and a very nice lady got up. Unfortunately, I put her to tears, and she was very angry. Picked up a jelly donut, and she was sort of, all you have is bad news, and she threw it at me. And it's the only time I've been physically assaulted for my forecast, and the bank president steps in and he says, hey, good news here is that if you know what's going to happen, you can protect yourself. And I mean, if you can change the system, great. I mean, this can be done. I hope it can be done. I'm afraid we're. I know we're too late to do this without significant disruption to the existing economy and probably politics as people know it. We'll have to see how it evolves. But from an individual standpoint, you need to look to protect yourself and your family. Shy of a major political change here in the upcoming election, and I think you'll see. You'll see some surprises there that'll move away from the standard political group that's controlling Washington. Probably not enough to make a big enough change at this point, but you know, there are enough people who are dissatisfied that you may start to see some political shift at the polling booth. I don't see a way of avoiding a major. Collapse here in the dollar as the rest of the world views it. As we move along, dollars are going to become increasingly undesirable. You've seen a lot of things happen there already. You now see some of our friends such as China and Russia having moved to try and get the dollar removed as a global reserve currency. If that happens, it'll accelerate the rapid decline of a U.S. dollar against the most of the major currencies in the world, and act as a proximal trigger for what will become a hyperinflation as a result of the broad long-term sovereign solvency issues of the United States. It's a hyperinflation, or very high rate of inflation domestically, that is. The type of thing that will destroy people's lives if they're not prepared. look to preserve his wealth and assets, and to ride out a very difficult time. The way I look at things is to, in terms of hedging the value of the dollar, holding physical gold and silver. Also, getting once those basics are covered, getting some assets outside the U.S. dollar. It's a type of circumstance that could lead to very unstable times in the United States. And I mean, you could see disruptions in the flows of, let's say, groceries to grocery stores. You may have electronic currency systems that can't handle rapidly accelerating prices. I mean, let's say someone has a credit card with a $5,000 credit limit on it, and a loaf of bread jumps to $5,000. How's that going to be adjusted? There are all sorts of issues. And I discuss this. I have a paper on my website detailing my outlook for hyperinflation, ways you can hedge it. But the beyond just holding gold and silver, the I don't know if you know Howard Ruff, Ruff Times, a gentleman who's been looking at problems evolving here quite rightly, only this over the last four decades or so. All the problems that the people writing about the dollar's demise in those days, those problems were right on the mark. It's just that nobody had an idea as to how long the system could be buffaloed as it has been. But now we've seen the end game. We've seen the panic of 2008, and that was the first big hit. But we're not going to get beyond the aftershocks of that, so that you need to cover yourself financially to get through the storm, but also look at doing basic things such as having a store of canned goods, toilet paper, things that you use day to day. Because if supply lines get clogged, get rioting in the streets, which I hope would not happen, but you can never tell how something like that will unfold. You're able to take care of yourself just as you would for a natural disaster. I live out here in California on the Hayward Fault. I don't live here because I don't think there's going to be an earthquake. I live out here to be near some family, and we're discussing the issues there. But you want to be you want to be prepared just as you would be for a major earthquake or a terrible hurricane along the East Coast. Be able to survive, I wouldn't say just a couple of weeks, but a couple of months, because the system will tend to stabilize. Whatever will happen, whether you end up with a barter system, as the currency system gets restructured, I don't know. But you have to allow for some period of instability where you have to be ready to handle whatever comes along.
Well, I think it's well said, and I hope that folks will also even take some of the more outlier scenarios, because we have to remember the U.S. dollar is still technically the reserve currency, even though hegemony is obviously eroding rapidly. So if suddenly the entire global system were to implode, you know, it could take you back to almost feudal times, maybe longer than 2 months. I would hope that folks would recognize that securing at least a year worth of dried foods, preferably beans, rice, things of that nature, is absolutely essential in every household. I'm not selling
it. I'm not selling anything either. I mean, my hyperinflation report's available on the website to anyone who wants to look at it. It is, however, something that, again, you just need to use common sense. What do I need to do to protect myself here? What could happen? If you think through the different scenarios, the insurance policies here are not expensive. I mean, buying goods that you'd otherwise utilize, but buy stuff that you can recycle. Just keeping an inventory of stuff that you would would use. There's virtually no cost to that. In fact, in the current environment, as things stand, you cannot get a positive risk-free return on your money in the United States. Inflation's running higher generally than short-term securities. So the Treasury securities. So you have a circumstance there where you actually would do better financially to go out and buy the goods that are inflating and hold them than buying you're putting your money in U.S. Treasuries.
But so, isn't this by design, though? By holding interest rates artificially low, of course, savers and retirees have virtually no other option than to try to game the system, constantly forced to keep their funds, their retirement funds, their capital in play, if you will.
They've been doing this. I can remember Mr. Greenspan had similar policies at a certain point in time. It's they're trying to force people who would otherwise save and were the backbone of the economy financially to trying to force them into the stock market, which I think is a very dangerous place.
And then if you somehow bypass all of that, all of the temptation there, then there's always the reverse mortgage. What's taken a lifetime to accumulate the equity in your home, something that you might pass on to progeny, and just throw that into the casino as well. Well, listen, as we wrap up, are there any other issues that listeners need to hear today regarding their portfolios, any other economic wisdom you'd like to impart?
One thing, I've had to become a specialist in the quality of government statistics. They do get massaged deliberately on occasion, and they certainly get massaged deliberately over a longer period of time with methodological changes. Government very deliberately understates the pace of inflation. That's to help cut costs on cost of living adjustments for Social Security payments. But if you believe the government's inflation numbers as a guide for your income or a guide for your investments, there's no way you're ever going to stay ahead of actual inflation. And most people may wonder why they can't stay ahead of inflation. That's one reason. They also deliberately overstate economic growth for variety of similar reasons, also heavily political. I'll take Main Street USA over Wall Street anytime in terms of an analysis of how the economy is going, or for that matter, over Washington, D.C. in terms of how the economy is going. The average guy's got a pretty good sense of what's going on. If it doesn't, what's happening doesn't make sense, I would go with my instincts or your instincts. You just don't trust the numbers blindly that come out of Washington.
We have put a lot of blind trust, I'm afraid, in just what has been disseminated via whatever media outlet you want. That's why we're trying to get as much of the truth and at least less, as you say, massage numbers. Well, it's going to be a requirement here for everyone going forward. Well, John Williams, we'd like to help our listeners today direct their web browsers to your website, sign up for your newsletters and any other important information. Can you give us some contact information?
Best just to go to the website, which is www.shadowstats.com, S-H-A-D-O-W, shadowstats, S-T-A-T-S, .com. And you'll find in the right-hand column there reports that are available to the public. Left-hand column are current reports. You get at least one report a week, sometimes two or three, depending upon the economic releases. And you'll see the headlines there, give you a sense of what's involved. There's also a place on the page you want to subscribe. Just click on that and follow the directions. We're always happy to pick up new subscribers. But again, you'll find a lot on our site that will enable you to get a sense of what's going on.
John Williams, we want to thank you for taking time from your busy day for us and wish you continued success.
Thank you, Chris.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Like a lot of people, with the close of summer beginning to resonate, I attended a family reunion this past weekend back in Michigan. With school still out and summer still in full swing, my experience in decades past has been that this is always a busy congested time of year to be driving around in the northern part of Michigan. Hotels are full, highways are congested, police are out in force writing tickets, and it just takes longer to get anywhere because there are always so many families hustling about, trying to get that last little bit of summer enjoyment in 1 month before another school year begins. Not so this year. The restaurants were not crowded. The hotels were not packed. I saw very few police giving speeding tickets, and very few police at all. The highways were not busy. The canoe trip tour guide had plenty of vacancies. The top web searches I performed for the area all showed comments for the economy, which included better than expected, better than advertised, economy will continue growing, and the like. Friends and family in the area shared a different story. Tight budgets, tight jobs, which is what I see repeated most everywhere. Official rhetoric and public projections about what federal and state authorities want us to think about the economy does not match the reality of what boots-on-the-ground analysis reveals, especially in an area where one has previous decades of comparison. Regardless of what you read, regardless of what you're told, regardless of what rosy picture academics and economic experts would have you believe in high-ranking Google articles, the economy is flat, stagnant, and getting worse. When an area that is traditionally bustling with family vacations 1 month before school starts isn't even breaking a sweat, it is cause for alarm. People are so tired and worn out just from surviving the past 6 years. That alarm bell is muted and has become a way of life everywhere. What should be screaming at people every day in the foreground has become so commonplace, it has blurred itself into the background of everyday life, to the point where many people, in order to survive, can no longer distinguish between the real economic threats that confront them every day. The media, the politicians, the banksters, our handlers have won this round in the game of psychological warfare. This is a very dangerous time. Personal defenses are down. Personal resources are low. Most people are very susceptible to official rhetoric or disinformation at a time like this. Actions are brewing on multiple fronts that will impact each of us. Will Obama's amendment to the 2003 executive order that called for quarantine of SARS victims, which he expanded last week to broadly include quarantine of people who exhibit respiratory problems, lead to what former Clinton advisor Dick Morris referred to several days ago as medical martial law, with the introduction of infected Ebola victims into the U.S.? Will immigrants being ushered into the U.S. under much controversy and political divisiveness ultimately be promised citizenship if they fight for the U.S., if and when the U.S. enters into a surrogate or direct military confrontation with Russia? As with all wars and military conflicts, we are marching down the garden path. Amnesia is developing in the public psyche regarding the root cause of these conflicts. Now we're on to more easy to understand cause and effect reasons for countries to go to war. Sanctions and the results thereof are a much easier sell. Root causes are forgotten. Then we forget that we forgot. Amnesia develops, and a new paradigm of war can begin. This is the process of how so many people can know what isn't so, can believe what isn't true, can understand what makes no sense. But that's the world we live in today. Your ability to think, to question, to anticipate the future and act on it in advance is still by far your greatest survival skill. Use it or you will lose it. Because once lost, nothing, not even your gold, will buy it back for you. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.